From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. A flash flood warning has been issued for the region downslope of the Holy Fire Burn area. Included are portions of southwest Riverside County and east central Orange County, like Trabuco Canyon. Malibu also bracing for potential debris flows from the Woolsey Burn area. We'll have the latest right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Hope you're handling all the congestion on the freeways with multiple accidents from the rain this morning. And of course, if you're downslope from the burn scar of the Holy or the Woolsey or any of the other major fires we've had in Southern California, we wish you well as you deal with that. Coming up later this hour, the latest on the Mueller investigation, including President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Pled guilty this morning to lying to Congress, regarded testimony about a planned Trump Tower in Russia. But first, neighborhoods downslope of the Woolsey and Holy fires bracing for possible debris flows. The National Weather Service, within the past half hour, issued a flash flood warning, alerting those in southwest Riverside and east central Orange County downslope of the Holy Fire. There are mandatory evacuations in a number of the canyon communities downslope from the Cleveland National Forest, and there are some schools that have been closed in that area as well. With the very latest from Cal Fire Riverside, Captain Fernando Herrera. Captain, thank you for joining us again today. Is heavy rain now falling in that area?
We do have some rain that's been very persistent since about 7:30 this morning. The time window frame that we were given by the Weather Service was from 7 till noon. So we've been experiencing some rain that could reach that threshold that potentially could have some mud flows and debris flows. So we're very vigilant throughout the at-risk areas, making sure that we're constantly monitoring those sites for any significant flooding potential.
What's your sense of the percentage of residents who've heeded the mandatory evacuation and left those canyon communities?
Well, yesterday when we issued the mandatory evacuation at 3 p.m., we estimated 1,017 homes were affected with about 3,500 residents. Of those, we're estimating perhaps 50% did not heed the warning and remained at home. So we're constantly monitoring those sites. Obviously, because we have a high percentage of population that was left behind, we want to make sure that we account for their safety. And in the event that something was to occur significant, we're able to once again reach out to them, make sure that they leave before a significant incident, if not be able to shelter in place.
All right. And what about the roads in the area? Is Ortego Highway still open?
Roads are still open. However, based on the rain, that could change at any moment. Some of the surface roads in the high-risk areas obviously are blocked off and closed, but that's just normal streets and subdivisions. Major arteries in the Lake Elsinore area along the Interstate 15 corridor are still open.
Okay. And on the other side of the mountains, I understand Trabuco Canyon, they're also watching that area very closely for debris flows that come out of the fire area. Given what you've been told by National Weather Service, are you looking at noon being the critical point? If by that point the rain diminishes, you feel like you're out of the woods?
Well, I don't think we're out of the woods until the rain actually clears itself and this storm passes through. Once again, it's not necessarily the amount of rain, it's the intensity that will fall on the mountainside that can cause the potential mudslides and debris flows and even some flooding. It's what accumulates in the tops and starts washing out. After the Holy Fire, all that scar area was left without any vegetation and the inability to absorb that water. That soil can absorb it, so obviously it will create some runoff. So then that can happen anywhere from an hour or two after the rain happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to happen during the rain.
All right. Thank you so much, Captain Herrera. We appreciate your joining us. He's in Lake Elsinore, downslope from the scar of the holy fire that happened months ago, and with the portion of the Cleveland National Forest there that was heavily burned. Of course, they're concerned about debris flows. Again, the National Weather Service said beginning just after 9 this morning, the Doppler radar indicating rainfall rates of a quarter inch per 15 minutes, and that that can last for an hour. So you might think an inch of rain in an hour, yeah, that's heavy, but not a huge deal. But when you've got the amount of mud and debris that can come down into those canyons, that's a big deal. Indian, Horse Thief, Temescal, Coldwater Canyons, downslope from the Holy Fire, all for concern, and flooding is possible in western Lake Elsinore, Temescal Valley, and along Ortega Highway 74. With us, the mayor of the city of Lake Elsinore, Natasha Johnson. Mayor, thank you for joining us. How's your city responding this morning?
Hi, Larry. Good morning. This morning's response is good. There is, you know, lots of angst in the community. Captain Herrera did a great job of kind of updating you as to where we're at. I wish more people would heed our warnings. We've been talking about this for months and worrying about the being desensitized to the message. Something that's really top of our mind is not just weathering this well, no pun intended, really just the saturation of the soil, because the holy fire burns so hot. The crystallization of the soil is very deep and 21 inches in some parts. So even after the storm is done, a smaller cell could come in, and that could be what triggers activation for debris flow, because our saturation levels are at their maximum capacity for a threshold. So we don't just get through the 12 o'clock hour or even this afternoon. You know, any storm cell at this point right now with this much rain at this intensity is cause for concern. So we're anxious, but we've done a lot of preparation. I think we have been blessed as a community to be able to have these few months to prepare. We have not taken that lightly, and we're as prepared as we can be. We have some cameras back in our canyons right now. We're watching, we have live feed to make sure, even if it's just a few minutes of heads up, that we have that. So that's kind of where we're at.
I'm wondering about the lake itself, because the fire burned just to the other side of Ortega Highway 74. Any concerns about debris flows having any effect on water quality in the lake itself?
Actually, it's so ironic. This is probably the first year in almost 20 years of being a resident in Lake Elsinore that I haven't prayed for rain. You know, it's a natural body of water, and rain is really helpful for our lake. At this point, the water, the runoff is decent, and it's good, and it's great for the lake right now. The debris flow, on the other hand, is a challenge. If we have that much debris flow all the way down to our lake, it's a large body of water. So right now, that's not our concern. Safety is our concern. The water quality will absolutely be impacted, but as a natural body of water, we're just going to have to see what happens.
All right, Natasha Johnson, mayor of Lake Elsinore. We wish the residents of your city all the best, particularly those canyon areas potentially affected. Thank you for joining us. Also with us, council member from the city of Malibu, Laura Rosenthal, to talk about the preparations there. Council member, thank you for joining us. What's going on in your community right now?
So we're doing, good morning, we're doing pretty well so far. We actually have some blue skies out there, though it was raining pretty steadily throughout the night and the morning, early morning hours. We've had all of our public works crews and county crews out there, especially monitoring certain canyons, Malibu Canyon, and some of our other areas. But we've done pretty well. We have some rocks down. But all the roadways are clear right now.
So it sounds like you didn't get the kind of heavy rain that was thought possible earlier. So you have to feel pretty good about that to this point. Are all the canyon roads, to your knowledge, still passable despite some of the rocks that have slid down?
Yeah, Malibu Canyon's open. Canaan did have some rocks coming down, but we had crews out all night, and they've cleared all the debris. And as we all know, rocks come down after the rain ends, so we all have to be very vigilant all along Pacific Coast Highway as well as the canyon roads.
And just also, you have any residents who've left as a precaution for this, or everybody pretty much staying in their homes through this?
I don't know of anyone who left. We did have the sheriffs go around to the areas that we were most concerned about yesterday and last night and just said, be prepared. We didn't want to do a citywide evacuation in any way because a lot of areas didn't need it. So we did talk to those residents that we were most concerned about. But as of right now, I don't know anyone who left.
All right. Councilmember Rosenthal, thank you. We appreciate your talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Laura Rosenthal of Malibu. KPCC correspondent Sharon McNary, who was with us yesterday for our deep look into utilities and their financial exposure from massive fires, is out in the Agoura Hills area earlier. She's now in Thousand Oaks at a debris basin, which, of course, is going to be tested by any large-scale runoff. Sharon, how are things looking in Thousand Oaks?
Yeah, well, pretty good, actually. I'm on a slope overlooking this very large debris basin called the Thousand Oaks Debris Basin. It's like one of nine similar basins that are really there to protect the public from, you know, the overrun of water and mud and debris that can come down in the hills after a fire. I mean, they're not really built for the fire debris. That can really overwhelm them. And so I've been following around some Los Angeles County flood control crews as they check the various debris basins and make sure they're not too full. I actually posted video of one of these on my Twitter account, KPCC Sharon, and you can see how the water is flowing through the burn scar and flowing into these drains that are established at various places in the hills.
We're going to link to your Twitter account on our Air Talk segment page also so people can see some of that video. Just getting out there this morning, any challenges or things look wide open, Sharon?
Well, the traffic was obviously horrible the first rain of the season off, you know, especially after the fire and trucks, you know, sideways. So it took us a long time to get out here. But once I was out here, I did talk to a resident who lives right next to one of these debris basins in Agoura Hills. And boy, he was really looking carefully at that water coming out of the hills. He had to do some work behind his own house to make sure that, you know, he was prepared. It turns out that the flood control district actually has civil engineers who will visit your home and advise you on what you can do if you feel like you're in peril of having any kind of, you know, mud or debris flow coming down into your yard.
Well, that's great. Hey, Sharon, thanks so much. We appreciate the update, and we'll look forward to your reporting throughout the day here.
You bet. Thanks very much.
All right, Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure correspondent, infrastructure that often is highly tested when we have massive wildfires and rain following with the potential for destructive debris flows. Sharon reporting throughout the course of the day right here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the former personal attorney to President Trump, Michael Cohen, pleading guilty this morning to lying to Congress about a planned project for a Trump Tower in Russia. We'll get the latest developments as well as potential timetables for the release of conclusions of the Mueller investigation back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later this hour, City of Los Angeles passing its new ordinances on sidewalk vending, making it formally legal throughout the city. There's still some specifics yet to be ironed out, but the city doing this in advance of a state measure that goes into effect in January. We'll talk about where you'll be apt to see legal street vending. That coming up later. But first, been a year and a half since Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel in the Russia probe. His investigations led to indictments against Russian intelligence officers, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, and President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen. This morning, a surprise appearance before a federal judge in New York had Michael Cohen pleading guilty to lying to Congress about work he did on an aborted project to build a Trump Tower in Russia. The president, in turn, called Michael Cohen a weak person, the president saying Cohen's lying to get a lighter sentence. With us to talk about the very latest developments, national security editor at Bloomberg, Larry Liebert. Larry, thank you for being with us.
Sure, good to be here.
Let's talk, first of all, about the specifics of the Cohen case. What is the testimony to Congress that Cohen admitted he lied during that presentation?
Well, he told Congress that talk about building a Trump Tower in Moscow was very tentative, and it ended in January 2016. And he laid it on heavy. He said this was before the Iowa caucuses. This was before any of the primaries. Well, in fact, he admitted today those discussions continued until June of 2016, when Trump was effectively the Republican nominee already. And so clearly he was not telling the truth about the extent of candidate Trump's contacts and potential business interests in Russia at the time of the campaign and at the time when Russia was meddling in U.S. politics.
And is there the potential for additional involvement of Cohen with Mueller's investigators here, as there had been ongoing conversations with Manafort?
Well, I think at this point he's got what he needs from Cohen. I think the indication is that Cohen, who had already pleaded guilty to charges in Manhattan and then was cooperating with Mueller, but he's told him what he knows. But I think the question then is what other avenues this opens up for Mueller, what other avenues Mueller is already proceeding on in his very secretive way.
All right. And additionally, what is the potential exposure to others in the Trump administration or people that were part of the president's team regarding any discussions with Russians about a Trump Tower?
Well, you know, the president said that this is all that Michael Cohen is a liar, that he's weak, and that he did give up these very tentative talks about a tower. And it wouldn't, by the way, the president said, it wouldn't have been illegal if he had pursued this thing as a candidate. There's no bar on that. But clearly, there's now a procession of people around Donald Trump, people who he had trusted, who are in trouble for not telling the truth. The president says it's because Mueller has been scaring them into making up stories. But, you know, one of the more interesting summaries today from a Democrat, Gerald Nadler, who's in line to become a head of the House Judiciary Committee, he said, if I could just take this off, the special counsel has now secured guilty pleas from President Trump's personal attorney, his campaign manager, his deputy campaign manager, a foreign policy advisor to his campaign, and national security advisor. The president can pretend this investigation has nothing to do with him and nothing to do with Russia, but these indictments speak for themselves. You know, so you do have that question. There are all these people around the president who at the very least were shading the truth a little about Russia contacts. Now, Rudy Giuliani, the president's attorney, said today, hey, they wouldn't have known this if we hadn't turned over all kinds of documents and information voluntarily that Mueller used to go after Cohen.
Well, and again, it's ironic, as we've seen in so many cases in the past, including Watergate. It's, you know, it's about the lies as opposed to the activity itself. So in this case, there was nothing illegal about conversations about a Trump Tower in Russia, even during the period of the campaign. But it's the lying about it which Cohen gets in trouble for here. Now, this is how defenders of the president are framing it, right? That there's not actual criminal conduct beyond lying about it or activities in Manafort's case that predate him working on the Trump campaign.
That's why these other questions, which are very uncertain in terms of the amount of evidence there, that there was collusion in Russia's illegal interference in the U.S. election campaign, that somehow people, Trump or people around him, were involved in that, and that somehow Russia had a hold on Trump. That's the other element that makes this illegal beyond, of course, the cases of lying to Congress or lying to prosecutors. And what Mueller has on this and what he's going to allege, we don't know yet. You know, he speaks only through his indictments, and it's clear he's not finished with those.
Want to thank you, Larry, for being with us, giving us the latest on today's guilty plea by Michael Cohen. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Bloomberg National Security Editor Larry Liebert with us on Air Talk. The Orange County Sheriff's Department has just issued a mandatory evacuation for residents of Trabuco Creek, that because of the threat of flooding and debris flows in the Holy Fire Burn area. So this is on the west side of the Cleveland National Forest, where folks in Trabuco Creek are downslope from the scar from the Holy Fire that happened months ago. Rose Canyon residents in Orange County, this is in East Central Orange County, they are under a voluntary evacuation order, and road closures continue for Trabuco Canyon Road at Rose Canyon and for Robinson Ranch Road. Just giving you the very latest on that. Also with us to talk about the latest developments in the Mueller investigation, former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general during the Clinton administration, Harry Litman. He's professor of constitutional law at UCLA and UC San Diego. You might have seen several days ago his op-ed piece in the LA Times titled "Mueller Might Soon Bring Charges That Even Trump Diehards Can't Trivialize." Professor Litman, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Good, good. So what leads you to believe at this point that there are likely blockbuster charges coming before year's end?
Well, I mean, that was eons ago. I think full days. So we've seen, in fact, quite an uptick of activity since. I mean, before about a week ago, Mueller had not even turned his focus, as far as the public was aware, in his public charges toward the U.S. side of the activity involving Russia, as you just mentioned. And now we've had a flurry of Manafort, Corsi, Stone, and today Cohen. All of them involve the alliance or coordination, or to use the wrong legal term, collusion, of Trump insiders or campaign officials with Russian government officials who, we know, at the time were endeavoring to interfere with the election. So just this morning's news, what you asked, Larry, why it's important. You know, you start with the point that Trump was adamantly denying it during the campaign, and there must be good reason for that. This Trump Tower project was his sort of Xanadu from way back. He very much wanted to have the golden tee atop the Moscow skyline, and there's been a lot of supposition, including in the famous Steele dossier, which has yet to be discredited in any particular, of a deep involvement on his part to make that happen, and that being the potential source of the clutches that the Russian government might have had on him. So the blockbuster points I made at the beginning of the week are coming true, except there have been a few curveballs for Mueller. So Manafort in particular, we were waiting to see what that statement would be that he'd asked for just a few days to make, and it turned out to be a declaration that Manafort had had broken the plea agreement and was no longer cooperating. And now there's more sort of mischief afoot with Corsi and Stone. But that's where Mueller is circling. It's all sort of front and center of the charges that Trump critics for months have been alleging were not forthcoming. It's, you know, it looks like he's marching pretty directly in that direction.
Well, and I guess ultimately, right, the defenders of the president say there's no evidence here that people who were formerly part of the campaign colluded with Russia on direct efforts to try and influence the election. And do you think, based on what you're seeing leading up to that, that there likely will be indictments that allege just such very direct efforts to coordinate with the Russian government efforts to influence the election?
Yeah, so I, you know, he is knocking on that door. Now, recall what he has already alleged and has good proof of on the Russian side. There are sort of two or three conspiracies. One is the whole kind of hacking mischief and false bots and the like that he alleged in February. One is the actual hacking of the Podesta emails and their dissemination in a way seemingly coordinated to help Trump. And the third is the Trump Tower meeting. All these three now are in intense focus. An important part of Cohen's plea today, again, is it puts the timing of the Trump Tower project directly in the middle of the Trump Tower meeting, so that they're talking about it just as the government meets there. And we have Stone, if Stone, say, who Mueller seems to be focused on, does turn out, as the evidence suggests, Stone and Corsi to be aware of the hacking of Podesta emails and their release. And remember, Stone says, you know, it will soon be Podesta's time in the barrel. Then the question becomes, does he share that with anyone in the Trump campaign or Trump himself, who he's in regular contact with? And I guess more importantly, perhaps, will Mueller gain evidence of it, because it looks as if both Stone and perhaps the president would be willing to simply try to stonewall it, so to speak, and deny. But those are the three focuses of activity we already have on the Russia side, and he's clearly stitching them together. Manafort was his best hope so far to locate it in the middle of the campaign, the campaign manager. Now that that relationship has imploded, what happens with the pieces that he picks up is unclear, but he knew that Manafort was lying.
All right.
Must have meant he had evidence that contradicted what he was saying. So always Mueller has more than we know him to have.
Let me bring into our conversation, along with Harry Litman, Justin Levitt, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in Justice Department's Civil Rights Division in the Obama administration, currently professor at Loyola Law School. Professor Levitt, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts, reading the tea leaves of what you think's likely to come and how quickly you anticipate additional charges in the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, so I thanks for having me on, first of all. Secondly, I agree with much of what's been said. Mueller is indeed knocking on the door, and ever more loudly and ever more closely. Keep in mind that we don't know what he knows. I think it was Larry who mentioned this before. He speaks only through his indictments, and so we know from him exactly what he's chosen to make public in charges so far, and they revolve around a seemingly endless stream of lying about contacts with Russia and when they happened and how they happened. And I think, as Harry just mentioned, that certainly indicates that somebody's lying to protect something. We don't yet know exactly what that was. We don't know whether Mueller knows exactly what that is. I would not be surprised to see further activity. I don't know the timing of it, but he is certainly choosing to ramp up the pressure with these additional indictments. And they come after the president has now submitted written responses that presumably he's testing for veracity. he knows that Manafort has been lying. He knows that Cohen has been lying. And if they have been getting their story straight with the president, that may also mean, caution, may, that may also mean that he now knows that the president is lying.
We should mention Manafort denies that he lied related to this most recent charge against him.
True. He's been denying a lot, and some of it he's been caught out as later agreeing, yeah, when I denied that, I wasn't actually telling the truth. So in a battle of credibility, I don't know that Paul Manafort's going to come out on top very often, but it is true. These latest charges he's alleged are not legitimate. There will be a sentencing position soon where the Justice Department lays out exactly how they think Paul Manafort should be punished for what they think is a breach of his agreement. And they will undoubtedly make more of the details clear there.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. That's Justin Levitt, Loyola Law School professor, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General, Justice Department in the Obama administration, Harry Litman in the Clinton administration, Justice Department Deputy Assistant Attorney General and former U.S. Attorney. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the city of Los Angeles's new measures on street vending. That after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to take a look at some of the latest in-car smart tech. The LA Auto Show is underway at the Convention Center. But at what point does some of this tech in the car become more trouble than it's worth? The manufacturers, of course, touted its ways making your drive safer, more entertaining, more convenient. But I want to hear from you whether you feel like it really has panned out that way if you're an owner of a newer car. See, I don't have to deal with that. I drive a 12-year-old Toyota. There is no... I got a radio. I got air conditioning. That's about it. Someday soon, I'm sure I'll be dealing with this. We'll take your calls coming up second hour. Right now, sidewalk vending in Los Angeles is officially legal. Unanimous vote yesterday by the LA City Council. The rules go into effect before a state law on street vending goes into effect in January. Time was of the essence for LA to get its ordinance passed. Now, the ordinance was first introduced by our guest, Councilmember Curran Price, back in 2013. This has been a 5-year effort. Councilman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be with you and the audience.
So your persistence has paid off now.
Well, it's been the persistence of many. You know, it's been a real collaborative effort between the vendors, the advocates, small businesses, governmental agencies. And so we all have been having this discussion for the past, for many, many months.
Explain how the state passing its law affected what Los Angeles had to do.
Well, it created certain benchmarks. If, for example, a local government does not have any rules or regs, then the state regs will kick in, which permitted vending everywhere, basically. So if you wanted to have any kind of control, any kind of regulations, it was important to establish them, and that's what we've done. Now, we still have some details to work out, exactly what the fee structure is going to be.
The permitting process.
But we've got a year to work those issues out, and we're excited about the educational process that we'll take part to encourage and to inform folks about that.
Do businesses have any sort of brick-and-mortar businesses have any sort of a voice here if there's a cart in front that might be
there certainly is a way to dispute or to challenge a vendor, but there's no veto. That was something that we talked about back and forth. So businesses do not have a veto over a vendor that's in front of them. But there is a process for adjudicating disputes and problems that may arise.
Now, some of the tourist areas, City Walk, Hollywood Walk of Fame, some of the other high traffic areas, will there be any street vending in those parts of town?
No, we're going to restrict the kind of vending in those areas because of the crowds, because of health and safety reasons. So around venues where, you know, the major parks or amusement areas, there will be certain restrictions preventing vending on those locations.
Hollywood Bowl, for example.
Hollywood Bowl, the Coliseum, L.A. Live.
All right. What about distance between vendors or concentration? Can you limit the number of vendors, say, on a city block?
Well, we attempted to do that. The state law says you can't. You can limit the distance between them, however. And so we're looking at 3 feet a distance between, a little smaller distance in parks. But again, those are the kind of details that we're going to be working out over the next several months.
Could you have certain communities where, even with the 3 feet buffer, you've got essentially, you know, carts lined up all down the street?
Well, you know, again, that certainly would have to be addressed on a health and safety kind of a process. Obviously, people just lined up straight, that might be a hazard of sorts. But a community cannot just opt out and say, no, we don't want to have it at all. No, the state has opted in to say that is not possible.
Kern Price, L.A. City Council member. He represents a portion of Central and South Los Angeles, the western swath of downtown L.A. Also with us, Stuart Waldman, the president of VICA, the Valley Industry Commerce Association. Thank you so much, Stuart, for being with us. Your concerns about the city's new bill?
Well, you know, a lot of our concerns were unfortunately cast out by the state law. The business community had been negotiating with Councilmember Price and others to try and limit the amount of vendors per block, to also request permission from the owner that the vendors would be set up in front of, because we felt that that would be fair. The state law, knowing what the city was negotiating, decided to completely usurp that and take those out of play. You know, the biggest thing here is enforcement. You need enforcement to make sure that people are permitted. We also had hoped that there would be space of 1,500 feet between each vendor, but the city decided to go for 3 feet. As you can imagine, there will be some streets that will be completely lined and up with vendors. There's nothing to stop a hot dog vendor from setting up shop in front of a hot dog restaurant. There's nothing to stop someone selling LA Dodgers or LA Rams memorabilia from setting up in front of a sporting goods shop. And it ends up, unfortunately, hurting the brick-and-mortar businesses, which could cost jobs.
Well, yeah, Councilman.
Yeah, well, so we certainly are sympathetic to brick and mortar businesses as chair of economic development. I want to make sure that all of our businesses are thriving. The reality is, you know, folks who are selling goods and providing services now, the difference is we have no regulations. And so I'd much rather regulate it, provide some parameters for how and when the vending takes place, as opposed to a free-for-all system that exists.
But for Stuart's point, is there going to be any money for enforcement? Will there be any additional personnel to enforce all the different?
Well, absolutely, and we're going to be ramping up to see exactly what's going to be required to make that happen. There is a preliminary budget estimate, but that will be increased as we determine the number of licenses that are going to be issued and the kind of enforcement that's going to be required.
I'd love to hear from Air Talk listeners. What do you think of this? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Also with us, Executive Director of the Leadership for Urban Renewal Network, which has advocated for legal street vending, Rudy Espinoza. Mr. Espinoza, thank you for joining us. Was there more that you wanted to see in these rules that would be vendor-friendly than ended up being passed?
Thanks for having me, Larry. Yes, well, first off, I want to thank Councilman Price and his leadership and the City Council for moving forward. And this is an important milestone for the City of Los Angeles. We've been advocating for years on this front with street vendors to make sure that vendors are included in the economic development strategy of our city. Yesterday was a milestone. We are celebrating and we're happy. It's a great step forward, but there are things, Larry, that we're worried about. For example, one of the things we're concerned about is on that list of areas where there is restricted vending is Hollywood Boulevard, specifically the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And we hope that as the regulations are developed, that we can work together to amend some of those things, because there's been a lot of vendors. There's a lot of vendors that we know that have worked for years on that boulevard and want to be part of making sure that Hollywood is a cultural destination for the world. We're also concerned about some of the park restrictions. Councilman O'Farrell amended some of those in the committee on Tuesday, but we're still concerned about some of them. For example, there is a specific restriction that says there could only be 2 vendors per acre in a park, and some parks can accommodate more than that. And so we, the LA Street Vendor Campaign, wants to work together with the city departments and the city council to make sure that we can work on a proposal that works for everybody.
And what do you think would be a fair permitting fee once over the next year the city comes up with that process? What do you think would be a fair amount for vendors to pay for the enforcement of this?
That's a great question, and I just want to also co-sign with Stuart on the importance of enforcement. The LA Street Vendor Campaign sees the need for enforcement to make sure their program works. You know, we've always been advocating for an affordable permit process, because if a permit process is affordable, that means more vendors will comply. And we've done a lot of research from cities all over the country to see how much they charge, for their permits. And so we have recommended ranges and have talked to the city departments, and we look forward to continue to do that. We believe that that's one of the things that moved forward yesterday is the process to develop a permit system begun. And so we look forward to working with the departments to create something that's great. And the revenues from that permit system will help support an enforcement program. We hope that that enforcement program really invests and leads with education to help micro-entrepreneurs contribute.
Know the rules. But can you give any sort of a range of what you think would be fair for an annual permit to do street vending?
Well, I'm a little shy to give you a range because, I think that there's a lot of things to
okay.
consider.
Okay. We'll continue our conversation. That's Rudy Espinoza of Leadership for Urban Renewal Network. He's executive director. They've long advocated for legal street vending. Yesterday, unanimously, the LA City Council approved its street vending ordinance. Councilmember Curran Price with us, Stuart Waldman, president of VICA. We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute. Street vending now legal in the city of Los Angeles. We're talking about what the limits are on it and hearing the pros and cons of the ordinance that was passed. LA City Councilman Curran Price with us. Rudy Espinoza of Leadership for Urban Renewal Network advocating on behalf of street vendors, and Stuart Waldman expressing some concerns, most of all about the state bill that was passed, which made it much more difficult for cities to have more intense regulation of street vending. Stuart Waldman of VICA, he's president of that pro-business group. I welcome your input on legal street vending, your concerns, your things that you'd like in it, that you don't like in it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Councilman
just
Price.
When we took a break, there was a discussion about enforcement. And
yes.
I just wanted to
chime
in.
And the cost of a license.
And I support the comments of both, that enforcement is going to be important. We envision the Bureau of Street Services providing that enforcement at the city level. And, of course, in the parks, the park rangers would oversee enforcement.
What's the Bureau of Street Services? What do they typically do?
Streets.
So like parking tickets?
Yeah,
is that their
okay. And repairs and things of that nature, yes. So, but, we'll take a look at and see if we need to grow that and how much and to what extent the police get involved. All these are questions that we want to make sure that we think through. But I agree, enforcement is going to be very important.
Kent in Palos Verdes Estates, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, this is a perfect example of politicians getting in the way of commerce and just getting it all wrong. They're not just going to be affecting these low-income neighborhoods negatively with trash and garbage everywhere. They're not going to be just affecting these low-income neighborhoods by reducing employment. which is going to affect the tax base, which is going to affect the funding for public schools. They're going to affect the jobs in these neighborhoods. They're going to affect urban blight. Stores, brick and mortars are going to be boarded up, which increases crime in these neighborhoods. They're going to give the green light for street gangs to come in and shake them down for money. This is just a classic example of individuals pandering to a non-specific group that does anybody no benefit.
Kent, appreciate your call. Rudy Espinosa, you want to respond?
I think, how do I respond to that? I disagree with a lot of the assumptions that are being made there. We see the average Angeleno sees all the positive contributions that street vendors make. Every time I tell people that the city of Los Angeles did not have a permit system or regulatory system for street vendors, they were shocked because many folks patronize their local taco vendor or their fruit vendor. And we have seen that vendors contribute to our neighborhoods all the time, and now the city is recognizing that.
Absolutely.
So you're not, let me just say, you're not concerned that brick-and-mortar businesses selling the same products as street vendors, when the stores have to pay the rent, the overhead, all the other employment costs that the carts aren't paying, you're not concerned brick-and-mortar are going to suffer?
No, and in the the LA Street Vendor Campaign has done a lot of outreach and work with brick and mortar small businesses, and many of them say, "Hey, we see how they add value to the street. They're going to help us attract more customer base."
Stuart Waldman of Vica, your thoughts on that?
Well, I haven't talked to a single brick and mortar business owner who has said that, so we must be in different neighborhoods talking to people. I think that there is a fundamental unfairness that the people who sign leases, pay rent, invest money, are now could show up to their business one morning and have five street vendors right in front of them blocking access. And, the enforcement part, there's nothing that's going to stop a street vendor from just blocking an entire street where people can't get by.
Councilman.
I think there will be enforcement. It's not going to be a situation I think that anyone would tolerate. Certainly, even under existing rules and regs, you can't impede the sidewalks, and so
Stuart's making the point
addressed.
Though that the city can't even close down.
While I agree, street vending is a new phenomenon here in Los Angeles. We have cities around the world where vending occurs. And the brick and mortar businesses haven't folded up and gone away wholesale. I think we have to be flexible. We have to be responsive, and I think we have to be creative. And I think that if we do all those things, we can find some accommodation for vending
but
for brick and mortar.
Is it fair to compare other cities around the world? LA has very specific demographics. A lot of immigrants who've come from other countries who, because of language barriers and the like, might see the cart as the way to getting a job they couldn't otherwise. You might have such a larger number of carts here than the other countries that you're thinking of, where they add sort of color and a sprinkling of urban life.
Yeah. Well, we got a larger number of people here too, so I think the opportunity to expand the base of our businesses, of our offerings, is certainly worth the effort that's involved in regulating street vending.
And you believe that the city can enforce this, given the city's challenges enforcing a lot of other stuff?
Well, I think that if there's a willingness to do so, we will. We know that it's going to take resources. We know it's going to take some education. And I think we're committed to doing both of those, just making sure that it works as smoothly as possible.
Councilman Curran Bryce, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it. He first brought the measure to the council back in 2013. Yesterday, it passed unanimously in anticipation of state law that goes into effect in January that would have limited cities' future abilities to put any sorts of limits on street vending. City of Los Angeles taking the action yesterday. Rudy Espinosa, Leadership for Urban Renewal Network, which advocates for street vendors, and Stuart Waldman of Vica. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our next hour, we'll take a look at a proposed bill in Sacramento that would levy a 17% tax on money managers. Would that drive that business out of California? We'll talk about it next hour. Pleasure to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Got a lot coming up later this hour with the LA Auto Show going and all this emphasis on new in-car technology. We're going to ask, at what point does this just become too complicated to use and doesn't really offer any added driving experience? We'll get to that and open up the phones. If you've got a newer vehicle that has some of this tech, I'd like to hear what you like, what you don't like about it, what was intuitive, what not, and what was more trouble than it was worth to learn. That's coming up later this hour. But first, the Los Angeles City Council voted yesterday to pass a resolution saying that the city supports legislation that would apply the state's hate crime protections to homeless Angelenos, the idea being that they would be a protected class under hate crime legislation, just like people because of their race, their ethnicity, their religion. Those are all protected currently. So you can have enhancements if a crime is committed against someone, and one of the underlying reasons for the crime was because of their identity in one of these areas. We're scheduled to have with us LA City Council member Monica Rodriguez to talk about it. She's a supporter of expanding the definition of hate crimes to attacks on the homeless. Also with us is the president of Community Advocates, Inc., the LA-based law nonprofit. He's the former regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, David Lara. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me back.
Now, you had a role in drafting the hate crime bill that goes back to the 80s, right?
Yes, in the mid-80s, I helped draft the legislation. ADL had an effort around the country to have hate crimes legislation adopted, and California, I think, was the first one.
Really? So, what do you think about extending this to include homeless Angelenos?
Well, as an old civil rights lawyer, I have a little bit of a reticence in this area. It's all well intentioned, but it's a little bit like a Christmas tree. You're adding another decoration. It doesn't add much. There has to be an underlying crime. The hate crime is not a crime in and of itself. There has to be a substantive crime underlaying the charge, and then if it's motivated by hate based on, as you mentioned, race, ethnicity, religion, nationality, sexual orientation, there can be an add-on. It's not a particularly onerous add-on, but it's an add-on in terms of the penalty that is the punishment that is exacted by the court. I'm not sure I think it's for the exact same reason that Jerry Brown vetoed this legislation. It doesn't add anything in particular. And the fact is, hate crime legislation was intended to deal with immutable characteristics: race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation. Homelessness can be a temporary phenomenon.
For most people, it is.
And, I'm not sure by the seeming motivation of it, you could add it to just about any crime you want and say, well, he's a target and it's not nice. Being not nice does not make it a hate crime.
What I guess I'm wondering, what would you think of instead of someone's, residency status, it applying to someone who has a cognitive disability or mental health disability? I mean, because that's something that actually is more longstanding than whether someone's homeless.
Well, some statutes do include disability among hate crimes. I hate people who are in wheelchairs or something, or people who make on crutches. That's a little more makes more sense than the homelessness, which can be in many, as you mentioned, as many instances, is a transient phenomenon. And people can be motivated for all kinds of lousy reasons, but it doesn't make it into a hate crime as the sense that the statute was initially conceived. Historically, civil rights statutes dealt with those kinds of immutable characteristics. That's where the hate crime statutes evolved from. Civil rights dealt in 64, and civil rights laws going back to the 19th century dealt with race, religion, ethnicity.
Well, I think of the reasoning behind hate crime enhancements is that we think of a corrosive aspect, that if a crime is committed in part or entirely because of immutable characteristics, someone's identity, that has a larger corrosive effect on society.
Exactly.
Above and beyond the crime against
right.
the individual.
It sends a message out that we targeted you, but everybody who's similarly situated could be targeted as well. And I'm not sure that works for the homeless. It may. There is some suggestion that it would work if I beat up one homeless this guy, send the message that everybody else in this area should get out as well. So there is a bit of that message. It's not a kind of sui generis act, but I think it's a different category than the hate crime categories historically.
We're talking with David Lehrer, Community Advocates, Inc. He was involved in the drafting of the state's mid-1980s hate crime enhancement law. I'd like to hear your thoughts as an AirTalk listener. Do you support the state extending hate crime protections to homeless residents? Now, City of Los Angeles with this resolution saying it supports this idea of the state including someone's status is whether they're housed or not in hate crime enhancements. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. With us, Los Angeles City Council member Monica Rodriguez. She represents the Northeast San Fernando Valley of the City of Los Angeles. Councilwoman, thank you for joining us. Why do you think it would be good to extend hate crime protections to this segment?
Well, because I think it's important that as a value system, we are protecting the most vulnerable. And right now, with the unprecedented levels of homelessness that we've been experiencing and the uptick of attacks against this vulnerable population, I think it's important for us to make sure that as we are leading the effort to house them, to connect them with services, that we also protect them, because homelessness is not a crime. And these are individuals that are the most vulnerable, that are exposed to, elements and environments that are beyond their control. And I think it's important that as a people that they are protected from some of the, negative portrayals and degrading portrayals, which increase the likelihood of them being targets.
Well, and what about the idea of instead of whether they're living on the street or not, a cognitive disability or mental health disability, particularly for the chronically homeless, not the temporary homeless, but chronically homeless, so often there are cofactors involved. What about those being aspects of protection?
Well, I think individuals, again, there's individuals that are protected. This is specific to people that are living on the street and right now because of circumstances that beyond their financial ability enable them housing. We want to make sure that they are not going to be targeted because they are vulnerable and they are left exposed to individuals who, again, oftentimes you hear the negative portrayals that are associated with homelessness. And I think it elicits a kind of reaction and invokes a kind of behavior oftentimes that makes them targets. And it's about making sure that we say that we are not going to accept that. We are not going to tolerate that. And this is part of our value system of protecting the most vulnerable in our community.
Again, I'd like to hear from our listeners what you think about this. Would you like to see the state of California expand hate crime protections to include homeless residents? 866-893-KPECC. Councilwoman Rodriguez, do you anticipate that there will in the next state legislative session be another attempt to pass this bill?
I have reached out to the speaker, Speaker Rendon, and right now they are in recess, but this is a conversation that will ensue once they resume. And yes, I'm optimistic that we will continue to move forward in making progress and attempting this again.
And does the resolution that the council passed yesterday have anything substantive beyond just saying we support this effort and want the state to pass it?
Right now, it's again, we do need the state's assistance in helping to draft this, to incorporate that. And so that's why this is a statement about what our value system here in the City of Los Angeles is, given all of the work that we are doing at unprecedented levels to house the homeless, provide safe parking, all the number of activities that we're doing, that homelessness is not a crime, and we want to make sure that individuals who are living in public spaces are not victims of hate crimes. And so, this is part of the value system of what we're working with in the City of Los Angeles, and we're going to continue to work with our allies in the state legislature to help make sure that we protect our most vulnerable.
L.A. City Council Member Monica Rodriguez, David Lariff, Community Advocates, Inc., and also with us from Cal State San Bernardino, where he's Professor of Criminal Justice and directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, Brian Levin. Professor, you're also a member of the board of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Do we have any sort of a count on homeless people who were victimized because of their unhoused status?
Oh, yeah. Well over 400 in the last, let's say, 17 or 18 years that were killed nationally. And here's the thing, though, and this is important. We are talking about a qualitatively different type of victimization criminologically, and homelessness fits it. Now, politically, whether or not people want to put that into a hate crime statute or a vulnerable victim statute, that is a political question. But we are seeing a targeted community, and mutability has never been a condition for inclusion in hate crime laws. So, for instance, religion is mutable. Disability is mutable. Public identification with respect to gender has been mutable. In other words, people change during their lifetimes. So that's never been a condition. The only immutable characteristic really is race. Age, for instance, mutates as well. But nevertheless, here's what we've seen. Even with regard to offenders, they fit almost hand in glove to the types of offenders that we see with hate crimes overall. Thrill offenders who do it on shallow prejudices revolving around negative stereotypes, then a reactive defensive offender, someone who might hurt a new ethnic family moving into a community, might be the same kind of person who would beat up a homeless person that's not threatening them somewhere in their community, and then mission offenders. So like a neo-Nazi skinhead murdered a homeless black person on Hitler's birthday. We see this all the time. Now, what I'd like to do, if possible, is I have a basic agreement among civil rights folks here in California to, at the very least, let's add homeless now to the state's vulnerable victim statute and protect them now, and we can debate about this other stuff later.
What is the vulnerable victim statute? I'm not familiar with that.
Sure. There's a statute here in California that heightens the penalty on a crime if someone is elderly or disabled. And indeed, in many states, there's overlap. So disability is covered in both.
All right. David Lair, does that make sense to you?
That makes more sense.
Because they are vulnerable. Yeah.
It fits better there than it does under the hate crime statute.
So you'd be okay with that, Professor?
It's not that I'd be okay. I represent a series of interests, and this is kind of an agreement going forward for California that we were working on. This all bubbled up right in the middle of these delicate negotiations. So what I'm saying to you is, if there's the political will and I could wave a magic wand tomorrow, I would add the homeless tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, I live in the world of what can be accomplished, not in a fantasy land. So I think we have the political will to add homelessness to the vulnerable victim statutes. We have over a half a dozen states.
Okay.
If we could do it, I would do it.
Professor, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned over 400 individuals killed in the past couple decades, homeless people who were targeted. How do you break that out as specifically because those individuals were targeted for being homeless versus all kinds of other conflicts and problems that occur with a vulnerable population like this? How do you get clean numbers?
That's a great question, and that's why we're not coming out with a report right now. But let me tell you what we try to do. We try to take attacks by domiciled people where there does not appear to be any other apparent motive, like a personal dispute, a drug deal gone bad, or a robbery. There's actually a subculture popularized by these bum fights films, where in many places it's regarded as a youth rite of passage to beat up homeless people. And they're burnt, they're drowned, they're maimed. It really does represent a targeted type of violence.
Okay.
I'll debate David. He's a brilliant colleague and friend, but let's protect them now.
All right. We'll continue our conversation with Brian Levin, Cal State San Bernardino professor, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, David Lair, Community Advocates, Inc., Monica Rodriguez, L.A. City Council member. And I want to take your calls and hear what you think. Should homeless Angelenos or homeless Californians be covered under hate crime enhancements if they are victimized because they're living on the streets. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll continue on AirTalk in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. The LA City Council yesterday voting to pass a resolution encouraging the state of California to expand hate crime protections beyond race, ethnicity, nationality, religion, age, to include homelessness as a protected category under hate crime law. What do you think of that? Should the state do that? We're at 866-893-KPCC. John in downtown Los Angeles, what do you think?
Yes, it's a must. It has to be done. Simply because I was a witness to violence, and when I was homeless, things happened to me.
Where you were targeted because you were on the street?
Yes, they figured that the person's homeless, don't nobody care about them, or the person's homeless, so they can get away with it. And I've seen so much bad stuff happen, and really, this should have been a law a long time ago.
And why do you think that there need to be additional penalties beyond, say, assault or any of the other applicable, you know, violent crime charges that could go against people who victimize homeless residents?
Because when you're homeless, it takes so much out of you on a day-to-day anyway. It literally takes and drains your body. So you are already not in the best of health. When you get injured just because some person wants to do something, it just exasperates it a lot worse.
All right, John, I appreciate it. Thank you, and glad that you're housed now. We appreciate your joining us on Air Talk, 866-893-KPECC. Doug in Santa Monica says, I can't believe we're wasting law enforcement resources on this. Why don't we focus our energies on finding homeless people homes and resources? Many of them are dealing with mental illness, and there could be a huge influx of false hate crimes. Councilmember Monica Rodriguez, are you concerned about that potential given the challenges in the homeless population?
No, I think, you know, we treat crimes, you know, we approach the investigations associated with those crimes all in the same way. But, you know, just to answer the other question or the other part of that is we are working vigorously and, in fact, making a really tremendous increase in housing the homeless, in building permanent supportive housing and opening up safe parking and bridge housing so that we can do that very thing. We are trying our best to get individuals off the street. We have expanded our outreach efforts, which have helped to also connect people to the resources that are getting them off of the streets. And so while we are doing that, we are also saying that we will not tolerate this type of behavior, and we want to see that these individuals are protected.
Moses in Newport Beach, what do you think?
Are we saying that the laws currently do not protect these people? I mean, is one life worth more than another? Hate crime laws are absurd. They do not offer equal protection under the law. If somebody commits an assault against a homeless person or any other race or color or whatever it is, it's an assault. It's period. Where do we draw the line? If I don't like wealthy people and I hate wealthy people, are we going to add wealthy people to the protected status? This is absurd.
So you don't like the idea of hate crime enhancements at all. You think it should just be whatever the crime is charged as such. David Lehrer?
Well, there is an argument to be made that hate crimes are an add-on and that the underlying crime is the most serious issue at stake. On the other hand, as I think we discussed, the implications of hate crimes in the protected categories is that it sends a message out. If you're targeting an African-American person, you're sending a message to other African-Americans that they're in danger as well, as opposed to the particular individual who has been the victim. So that is the concept underlying hate crime laws, that they are more insidious in that they send a message out to a broader community that they're at risk. Now, the question is, do you want to do that for homeless homeless, and are they a different category? I mean, the arguments that I've heard from Brian and from the councilwoman, why not child abuse? I mean, it's the same message. If it's a heinous crime and we want to send the message to other kids that they're protected, we could make them a protected class under hate crimes as well if we do it for homeless people. So it's a tough area because they're good. It's well motivated to include these categories. I'm not sure they make logical sense in the real world.
Well, it's funny because you're the guy who was involved in in the original legislation. You're saying that. All right. Brian Levin, Cal State San Bernardino. Quick response to why we have these at all.
Thank you so much. First, the law makes distinctions all the time, and young people are protected. The sexual assault against a juvenile is treated differently than against an adult. One other quick thing, though. People who are housed already have protections about zones of locations, trespass, burglary, breaking and entering. So what we're doing is we're having people who don't have those physical protections and depriving them of those legal protections as well. We have law that protects space, but people who can't afford their own space don't have those protections as well. The law makes distinctions all the time about class, about the type of person, about vulnerability and location, and when we see a targeted class based on prejudice, like these bum fights attacks by domiciled people doing it for a thrill or Nazis doing it to clear their neighborhoods, I think society has a right to send this message out and the legislature has a right to make the decision. Whether it's vulnerable victim or hate crime, we have to do it now. People are suffering and dying.
We're talking with Brian Levin, Cal State San Bernardino. He's professor there and directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism. Let's take another call here from Paul, I'm sorry, in Anaheim Hills. What do you think?
So what I think is when it comes to crimes, they ought to, you know, there is a lot of talk of, you know, we need to show the values of what California thinks. And, you know, I sort of think of what John Stuart Mill wrote on Liberty. The principle for what should be law and what shouldn't be harm. It shouldn't be precedented upon values, whether they be moral or otherwise. The crime, the charge for the crime ought to be the same, regardless of the motivation. Earlier, the neo-Nazi murdering the black homeless man, that was mentioned. Why should his crime be any different than, say, if one person just murdered another out of the blue?
All right. Paul, I appreciate it. Johnny in Long Beach says, I was homeless in Venice Beach, and I was victimized by gang members, by police, Johnny would like to see these enhancements put into place. Ellie in San Pedro says, we need to make it a hate crime. Even the pastor at my Catholic church says hateful things about homeless people and says it's a government problem. Let's make it a government problem and make it a hate crime. To assault them, they need more protection. Michael in Orange County, you often post on the page, and I appreciate your posts. I think the post that you put today is not acceptable. I understand your frustration with the numbers of people that are living on the street. Please take down that posting because that's simply unkind. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. My thanks to David Lehrer of Community Advocates, Inc., Brian Levin, Cal State San Bernardino, and L.A. City Council member Monica Rodriguez. Coming up, proliferation of technology in cars, on smartphones, in our everyday life is supposed to make our lives easier, right? Well, a lot of times that's not the case. I want to hear from you. What are some of the most challenging tech that you've encountered, whether in a new car, on your phone, a hub in your house? And what were you resistant to only to find it really did make your life better once you sat down and figured out how to use it? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You know, yesterday I completely dropped the ball. We were having that conversation about favorite animation in childhood. And going into the break, I said, when we come back, I'll tell you about Hedy Lyn Hurdy's and the her starring role in cartoons, and then promptly forgot to do it when we came back. I apologized to Hedy afterwards, and she says, you should just blame your producer. That's No, that would not fly. Anyway, Hedy did a number of female characters on the old Filmation animated series Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle, with Bob Ridgely, who starred as Tarzan. And she did a number of different characters on that popular TV series in the past. Hedy has her update standing by coming up shortly. So my question for you is, what tech, whether in your car, your handheld device, your home electronic hub, what tech were you resistant to that you actually at some point figured you'd give a try, only find now you absolutely love it? Maybe you don't even want to consider living without it. Or what other things did you find came with your car or with some other, you know, device that is just more trouble than it's worth and, in fact, has made your life worse? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With us is Scott Evans, features editor of Motor Trend. He's at the LA Auto Show in downtown Los Angeles, which is just getting underway with the media days, the public able to start attending tomorrow. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tech for the past couple years or so has been a big part of all the auto shows. What are some of the breakthroughs you're seeing so far?
The big breakthrough everyone's jumping into right now are personal assistants. And we think of them as Alexas and things like that. And automakers want to bring them into the car. We've got now Mercedes-Benz and BMW both have introduced into cars that you can buy very soon that their own assistants that you can talk to and can sync to your calendar and will, you know where your home is and what time of day you're usually heading that way or which way to go to work and all those sorts of things. So if you like that kind of, you know, personal assistant, they're coming into your car too.
Why would you want that to live in the interface with your car as opposed to a connected smartphone that's always with you and the smartphone connected so that that's the interface but still coming through the vehicle?
The trouble is with who controls the software and who owns the data. The car makers aren't ready yet to just invite Google or Apple or anyone else into the car's computers to run everything and completely take over. And then there's a big question of any data that's sent, received, gathered through your car, does that belong to the automaker? Does that belong to Apple or Google? Does that belong to you? So they're trying to sort of walk in between and introduce their own systems so that your car is sort of your own moving office.
No, I understand why the auto manufacturer, because they want access. But I guess from a consumer standpoint with, what is it, CarPlay and Android has its version that you sync up with the car, why you would want to have any go through the car manufacturers instead of through whatever, you know, device interface you've already got?
I think if you're the person who likes these assistants in the first place, you like what it can do for you, right? You can talk to your car conversationally and tell it where you want to go and whether you want to avoid highways or what you need from it or to remind you about, you know, a phone call you have in 20 minutes, things like that that you do hands-free is the big push. You don't have to look at your phone. You don't have to push a button on it or anything else. You can simply speak to the car while you're driving and keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the steering wheel.
All right. We'll continue our conversation on Air Talk with Scott Evans of Motor Trend, and we'll talk with CNET's Roger Cheng, find out about some of the most interesting tech that is supposed to make our lives better connected, easier, increase convenience. But I'd like to hear from you what you really think of this sort of, you know, Air Talk listener reviews. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back right after this live update from former animation star Hedy Lyn Hurdy. I sure hope to see you this coming Sunday at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our next Film Week screening. One of my favorites, The Artist, the Best Picture winner of 2011. The film that's set right here in Los Angeles, as are all of our Film Week screenings. It shows us what went on during the film industry's evolution from silent to talking pictures, all filmed around Los Angeles on location. And I welcome you joining us at the beautiful historic Theater at Ace Hotel this Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, after the screening of the film on the big screen. What better way to see it than that? Then we're going to talk about the movie, about the film industry at the time depicted, talk about some of the great locations that have shown up again and again in films like The Artist. That's coming up this Sunday, 1 o'clock. Weather should be nice. That's what we hear from the forecast. We hope to see you downtown on Broadway. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. But right now, what we're talking about on Air Talk is in-car and in-hand technology. At what point for you has it become too much, just too difficult to deal with? Or conversely, what are the things you avoided you thought would be more hassle to learn how to use than what you'd get out of it, only to find just out of curiosity you spent a little time and now you can't imagine why you didn't use it before? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Deb messaged on our Facebook page for AirTalk, "I love all the new tech in my new Prius. The safety features were confusing at first, but I'm accustomed to them now. I feel unsafe driving a car without the beeps and displays that keep me from drifting or getting too close to the car in front or misjudging a parking space, so many other situations, not to mention the electronic options. Once you get used to them, you can't imagine not having them." That's Deb messaging on our Facebook page. Judith in Studio City, you're on Air Talk. What's your experience with high tech in your car?
Well, I purchased a 2018 Range Rover Supercharged this year, and the computer interface was horribly buggy. Went back and forth to the shop. It was completely useless, actually. I couldn't start the car sometimes. The screen was black, et cetera, et cetera. They couldn't fix it. I felt actually that it really was completely overdone and ended up buying my way out of the lease and going and buying a used 2012 that had the old system. I've had 5 to 6 Range Rovers prior to this, but I've never been so disappointed in tech, if you...
Yeah, yeah, Judith. And Scott Evans of Motor Trend Features Editor, I mean, this has to be the concern of some car manufacturers. You risk turning off, in Judith's case, a loyal customer of the brand.
Absolutely, and it shows in quality scores and rankings, the feedback they get back from the customers. You know, there's a desire from the designers and the engineer to have the latest and greatest tech to make, you know, the screens in your cars look like your phone and do all the cool things that your phone does. But you run the risk that, you know, if there's any sort of thing, we sort of expect cars these days to, you turn the key on and it works right every time, no problem. So when you have software glitches and things like that, it can really hurt the buyer's experience and can, yeah, really turn off loyal customers.
Also with us, Roger Chang of CNET. Roger, thank you as always. Good to have you with us today. Roger Chang, executive editor of CNET. What are some of the, you know, cutting edge things in personal tech that we're seeing outside of the automobile?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest trends, obviously, is the smart home, right? And to the earlier point about voice assistants, you know, having voice assistants via smart speakers like your Echo Dot or your Google Home Hub, having those around to kind of power the smart home. It's a great example of a technology that I think folks might be a little reluctant to get into initially because the setup is a little bit difficult and feels a little unnatural talking to a voice assistant, but you get used to it fairly quickly. And if you're willing to invest the time to, you hook up your home to these smart home devices, your life does get better over time, although I have to admit it is a fairly awkward transition to get there.
Yeah, and you feel like at this point that the payoff is significant enough, there are enough connected devices, you know, beyond the house's HVAC system and sound system to make it worthwhile?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it really does depend on how much time you want to invest, how much homework you want to do. But there are all manners of things, right? From door, from locks to air conditioning systems, light bulbs. Really, anything can be turned smart with a smart plug at this point. And having the ability to control all these devices with your voice, being able to program when they go on and off, a lot of it are there are tremendous amounts of benefits there. But again, you do need to put in some time to get it all working correctly.
I'm a loyal CNET reader, and you know I love this stuff. I'm fascinated by tech, but I wonder, even among your readership, do you get feedback in some cases that, hey, this is just, it's needlessly complicated. This is just offering me a bunch of stuff that isn't going to improve my life.
I mean, we definitely have folks who are reluctant or curious about smart home technology or all manners of technology. I mean, that's why CNET exists, right? We offer a little bit of guidance. We offer advice. We offer, smart choices on the devices you should be using, the types of technology you should be embracing. And there's definitely, with every new trend, there's a lot of questions, and that's what we're around for.
All right. We have Jason and La Quinta said, funny how a lot of new technology tries to complicate things that already work great. Much of the time, the simpler it is, the better it is. Let's see. Let's take a call from Bob in Long Beach. You're on Air Talk. Bob, what's your recent experience?
I have a 3-month-old Honda Accord with all the bells and whistles on it. And at 80 years of age, I'm finding some difficulty acclimating myself, even with instruction from the dealership, the YouTube videos, the Honda dealership, the Honda Motor Company, and the booklet they give you. But I have some solutions for it that really are applicable, and I've made it to the Honda Corporation, the dealership, and gotten nowhere. The bottom line with the thing, I have about 35 to 40% knowledge right now of that computer that's in the car. There are probably 20 to 30% features that I never will use. I don't even know why they're there, but I'm not going to use them at all. There's no purpose. I bought the car specifically with the purpose in mind of increasing my safety concerns as I age with the cars, with all the backup cameras and everything.
Driver assist features, yeah.
Precisely, and they work. The ones that I know about and how to use. Other features about this being on a highway and being able to automatically stop if you don't put your foot on the brake. I haven't used that yet because I haven't taken a highway trip. But basically, my solution is real simple. There's two parts to it. One is the Honda dealerships should take people that have brand new cars who would voluntarily go to a classroom instruction program at the dealership. And basically, a face-to-face person who knows the car would do a PowerPoint.
Kind of like what Apple stores do.
Absolutely. That's the model. The second part of it is, if the OLLI programs, Osher Lifelong Learning Institutes, which are all over the United States and Southern California, Cal State Long Beach has one, they teach all sorts of information about technology and whatever. They have a computer program. Basically, those classes are free. Why don't the dealers send people into the OLLI program, which are set up to handle educational informational programs, and show people how to use the technology?
Yeah, Bob, I appreciate that very much. I mean, particularly if, I don't know if you're retired or not, a good chance you are at 80, but, particularly for older drivers like that who would be able to fit that into a weekday schedule. Scott Evans of Motor Trend, how have the dealerships attempted to deal with the knowledge and education gap on in-car tech?
As you can imagine, it's an enormous challenge, and every brand has responded a little bit differently, but they are trying to bring as much of that in as they can, as they realize that the customers are struggling with some of these technologies, because every brand has a different user interface. Some of them use knobs, some of them are touch screens, some of them are touch pads that you move around like a computer. So when you've got all these different things, you'd have to have, you know, a representative from every brand go to CSU Long Beach to get these classes. So what they're trying to do is bring it into the showroom and have special staff on hand when you buy the car to give you the whole walkthrough, show you how to use all the features. And whether or not you have that at your local dealership could depend on a lot of factors. It could depend on the brand. It could depend on the dealership, if that's something that their customers are asking for, if they see value in spending money on the staff. And so, unfortunately, it's not universal, and it's very, I think it'll be a lot more common, though, as we get more and more of the second cars and as they become more complicated to use.
All right. We'll continue our conversation focused on in-car technology as well as handheld technology. Hear what you think about things that you wish maybe you'd sat down, figured out how to use earlier. Other things you tried, you just gave up on, you felt like they were more complicated than any touted benefit. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. The promise of tech to improve the quality of our lives, make it more efficient, more pleasurable. Where do you see that paying off in your car, your handheld device, in your home networking? Where do you feel like what's touted really fizzled out, didn't pay off in ways that provided any improvement, or maybe just too complicated to sit down and figure out? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Alana tweets at AirTalk, I despise touch screens for frequently used functions like volume control, air temperature in my car. It requires me to take my eyes off the road to use the functions. I could operate them tactily earlier. I'm a millennial, Alana says. You know, that's why I think, you know, for so many vehicles, they actually use the on steering wheel control. Scott Evans, hasn't that become fairly standard now?
The steering wheel controls are very standard, and there's even more. They're always coming up with new ways to do them. Certain BMWs, for example, have gesture controls where you can wave your hand around in a certain way and adjust the volume or change the radio station, things like that. And these are all things that, again, people are going to have to be taught how to use that they may not like. You know, people like touchscreens because they look so cool. They look like your phone. But, again, they require you to take your eyes off the road, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with that.
All right. Take another call. This comes from Mark in Torrance. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. My uncle enlisted the help of myself and my brother. He wanted to get a car with a driver safety package, and we started referring to it as the bad driver package because it's something that you can rely on and kind of not focus on driving. I think it was very telling when we went to the dealership and asked them if we could take the car on the freeway and test out the auto braking, and they said no. So I just don't think the technology is 100% unreliable.
Well, and I wonder, though, there, if that's sort of a reliability issue and we're concerned about the driver aspect of that. I don't know. But, Mark, it's interesting because you would think if one of the reasons you're buying a new car is to get the driver assistance and the tech safety package, that you'd like to have some way of seeing, you know, how difficult or easy it is to use that. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Roger Cheng of CNET, Scott Evans of Motor Trend was talking with us earlier about how the manufacturers want to have the interface provided by them, not through CarPlay, for example, being the voice-activated, you know, service. What are your thoughts about the pros and cons of that?
Yeah, look, I think there's a reason why CarPlay and Android Auto have gotten increasingly important. I know I've been looking for a new car, and it's having CarPlay is kind of on my must-have list at this point. You know, these software companies, these technology companies, they're constantly iterating, constantly making improvements on the interface, on the software. That's not something the automakers are particularly good at, right? They're good at making cars. They have often long, long lead times, years-long lead times in terms of development. And that doesn't work for folks who are used to having annual and sometimes biannual updates for their software. And so I think that's why CarPlay has gotten as popular as it is, being able to kind of sync up your iPhone to your car and using Siri, which admittedly Siri is not that great, but you're used to it, as opposed to some in-house built voice command system from, you know, Ford or GM or whoever. I mean, it's not necessarily – you don't necessarily trust an automaker for their software, and I think that's why it's – it's largely struggle. I think cars are automakers who insist on having their own systems, their own kind of in-house systems, tend to struggle relative to, you know, cars that embrace CarPlay or Android.
What about the cost involved in this? Because the more tech that you introduce into a car, whether it's the entertainment system, climate control, head-up display, whatever, you know, kind of tech you're talking about, when it goes wrong, the costs, you know, to repair it are significant. And how much are our drivers, do you think, Roger, dealing with this now?
You know, it's hard to say at this point, but it's a legitimate concern. And to be fair, I'm not an auto expert. We have our team of roadshow experts who review cars and review the technology in the cars for a living. But it's a valid concern, I think, with any device, whether it's a phone, whether it's a tablet, whether it's a car. As these things are getting smarter, as they include more sophisticated components, whether it's hardware or software, that requires that increases the chance, the risk that you need to update or constantly maintain them. And I don't think that's a complexity that people get right off the bat.
Well,
those folks focus on the benefits. They don't necessarily realize that there's some underlying risk there.
And Scott Evans of Motor Trend, I assume this helps the dealerships sell those extended warranties, which may or may not be a good deal. But when you're looking at the price tag of repairing some of the tech, maybe that sells some of those extended warranties.
I don't doubt it helps. The warranties, and you know, for some automakers have gotten so good now, we're seeing up to 10-year warranties. And generally, a lot of these devices and then features in the car are covered. There's always going to be a lot of fine print, but it is a big concern amongst a lot of auto buyers realizing that, yeah, at some point down the road, something is going to wear out, something's going to have a glitch or break along the way and need to be replaced. And it's going to be more expensive than, you know, bolting on a new carburetor.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for being with us. Scott Evans of Motor Trend, features editor, joining us from the L.A. Auto Show downtown, which opens to the public tomorrow. Roger Chang, who was the head of CNET. Thank you, Roger, for being with us. We appreciate it. You can share your comments about tech, both in your hand, in your home, well, and also in your cars, we've talked so much about on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. I'm sorry, I ran out of time to take some more of the good calls that we have lined up on the program. Tomorrow, Film Week at 11 o'clock, and I sure hope to see you this coming Sunday, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Sunday afternoon at 1, our next Film Week screening of the Oscar-winning Best Picture, The Artist. Beautiful L.A. locations. It's a gorgeous-looking film on the big screen on Broadway, right in the heart where L.A. Films were shown. kpcc.org/in-person.